Hi everyone, and welcome to the podcast of the European Society of Anesthesiology and Intensive Care, brought to you this time from our Euroanesthesia Congress in Glasgow. Now, I'm Paul McConnell. I'm going to be your host today, and I'm the Chair of Ethics for the Scientific Committee. Now, we're going to talk about probably one of the biggest and most important topics to face anesthesia, and that's sustainability. It's my sincere pleasure to be able to introduce Dr. Ken Barker to us, and he is part of the Green Anesthesia Scotland group. Ken, it's lovely to have you with us.
Thanks,
Paul.
Do
you want to just give us a wee bit more of an introduction about yourself?
Sure. Kenneth Barker is my name. As you say, I'm a consultant anaesthetist in Rigmore Hospital in NHS Highland, in the north of Scotland. I have a couple of other roles now. I'm clinical lead for a programme in Scotland called the National Green Theatres Programme. And I'm also currently chair of the Environment and Sustainability Committee at the Association of Anaesthetists down in London.
And that's great. And I think we'll return to the Scottish National Green Theatres project later on in the podcast. I suppose we want to take things from basics here to start with. So, as anaesthetists, how does our practice affect the environment?
Yeah, it's something we're all becoming more conscious of now. There are headline figures that we know about. 5% of Scotland's carbon footprint is attributable to healthcare activities. Centre for Sustainable Health put out a figure a few years ago saying 80% of that 5% is attributable specifically to clinical pathways, which I think surprised a few people because we assumed that the problems with healthcare were more to do with the estate and the heating and ventilation, etc. But clinical activities are actually a major contributor. What do I mean by that? Well, the everyday decisions that we make, whether it's drug choice or how we see a patient, etc., these are quite important. I'll kind of break it down a little bit for you.
Sure.
If we're practicing anaesthesia, talking about drug choice is obviously the one, as anaesthetist, that's very obvious is volatile choice. But even before that, do you need a general anaesthetic? Could you use a regional anaesthetic? Does the patient need an anaesthetic? Could they be done in a non-theatre setting under local? Do they even need the operation? So these are the questions you put to yourself. But when it comes to drug choices, you might choose to use a more environmental volatile, such as sevoflurane, and not use desflurane. We have got to the stage in Scotland now where this February we stopped procuring desflurane at the national procurement level. So we've made great progress in that. And it's probably the first time that I know of that a drug has been effectively banned on purely environmental grounds. So that's something. But there's other drugs. We use nitrous still sometimes in our practice, although that's more now a problem for colleagues in other areas of the hospital, dentistry, obstetrics, and there's work ongoing to look at that. And then we look at equipment. Equipment, we kind of have got into a single-use culture over the last couple of decades, and what we're looking at now is a kind of return, a back-to-the-future type situation where we look at our old practices of cleaning and decontamination, laundry facilities, these sort of things, and we're looking at how we can reactivate that sort of process and not utilise the resource, the rare resources that we are, you know, wasting in the kind of linear economy that we've got to. Kind of return to a bit more of a circular economy. If you look wider than that, we can look at things like energy usage. In our programme, we've got kind of work going on looking at simple things like turning off the lights when you're out effectively, you know, the things that are left on 24/7. I don't know if it's the case in other European countries, but I went around, asked around the Scottish hospitals, and basically things like HVAC systems, ventilation systems in theatre, and the anaesthetic gas scavenging systems, for the most part, they are left on 24/7 throughout the entire year. So we need to look at automated, user occupancy triggered management of these type systems to reduce energy.
And I think with those things as well, they've got both an environmental impact, but they've also got a big cost impact for the hospital too. Is that right?
Yeah, almost. So the program that the National Green Theatres program that we're talking about is a development of a pilot we did in Inverness called the Green Theatre Project, which was just 11 actions initially. It's now 50 or more actions. But one of the key things of this whole programme, and it's one we're trying to emphasise more, is that almost every action we're promoting is a cost-saving action. We're trying to use that green dividend that those savings come with to allow us to then, you know, to source money for other parts of the programme that might need a little bit of cash up front. But for the most part, they're cost-saving. To give you an example, we've just had a new facility built in my local area. Our programme only got started this past year, so we were too late to influence the design of this particular building. But the ventilation systems in theatre were signed off by the authorising engineer, and I saw the letter he wrote, and he pointed out that if you automated the ventilation, we would have 70% savings on energy in that building. And it's beyond me, really, that this has been known about since, many years. There's actually been guidance in Scotland since 2016, but we're still not actually implementing that guidance. So, leaving lights on is mad. Nobody would do it in their home, so why do we do it at our work?
It strikes me, actually, that, you know, we can get bogged down in a lot of high-tech things and stuff, but there's a lot of easy wins.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science to actually make a big impact. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. It's within our means and our power for most of the actions that I'm talking about, and they're common sense actions particularly. That doesn't mean that we're not really interested in innovation and new technology, and there is a role for that. But I think first and foremost, sort out our problems, our simple problems, like energy use, turning the lights out. But another example is the waste that our colleague Alifia Chikira had identified in Lothian in 2020, where it seems that basically there's not a hospital in the UK that doesn't waste anywhere between 80 and 95% of the nitrous oxide that they procure. It never sees a patient. It's lost in leaking manifolds, leaking pipeline outlets, and poor stock management. So, yeah, the changes that we need to make are very low tech for most of the part, and can be achieved by anyone.
And I think that's probably an important thing to take away here, because, you know, we want to have sustainable anaesthesia, but we don't want to compromise patient experience or safety. But from what you're saying with the nitrous example here, it's not about getting rid of nitrous, it's about getting rid of nitrous waste.
Yes, exactly. There's always a role for these sort of things. You know, I know that nitrous oxide is still used in paediatric inductions and some people in obstetric anaesthesia for general anaesthesia sections. But by providing that drug to them locally with a small cylinder attached to the machine, because they only use small quantities, you can decommission your manifolds and get rid of that waste. And it's now part of a thing called the Nitrous Oxide Mitigation Program. You can find it on the Association of Anaesthetists website and Royal College website. A step-by-step way of identifying the waste in your hospital and decommissioning these wasteful, old-fashioned, I have to say, methods of supplying a gas that we, for the most part, don't use now.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of these things, it almost feels like we've taken our eye off the ball sometimes with them. And it's actually when you start to measure and look for things, you see easy solutions to losses that you didn't even know were going on.
We didn't know, no. And our own experience in Highland is that, you know, things like medical gas committees, most hospitals in the past had medical gas committees that involved engineering side and clinicians. These things seem to have fallen by the wayside over the years. So what that's meant is that the clinical need has changed, but the engineering side of things, the people that look after our infrastructure, they didn't know about the clinical need changing, and so they are working to old demands and not recognising that things have moved on. And I'll give you another quick example. 7-bar air in our hospital is provided through a massive air compressor plant at the back of the hospital. It actually provides 7 and 4-bar air, but it's a big engineered facility. It uses a bit of energy. How often do orthopedic surgeons now, because it was used for air-powered tools, how often do orthopedic surgeons use 7-bar air now? In our hospital, it's all rechargeable battery, so they only use it for 4 minutes a day. That's 8 30-second bursts for cement mixing. And there's a couple of other indications. So I'm not saying that get rid of 7-bar air, but again, we can provide local cylinders of 7-bar air through a wall, so for the end user, no difference whatsoever. But we can de-engineer that plant at the back of the hospital, or for new hospitals, certainly designing a lower tech solution to the provision and save both energy and maintenance costs.
Yeah, I suppose then what you've alluded to as well is it's really important to get anaesthetic involvement, but we're just one group.
Yeah, anaesthetic and surgical, basically across all staff groups. You know, I had an email yesterday from a respiratory physician. We're involved with the haematologists, the ED doctors. It's across the whole hospital now. Although our program, the official program, is the National Green Theatres program, we're aware that this will spread to other areas within healthcare, and it'll spread outside tertiary or secondary care. It'll spread to primary care as well.
Now, you mentioned the National Green Theatres program a few times there.
Yeah, that's self-promotion.
It's all accessible online. But
yes.
I'm aware that you've developed some bundles.
Yes.
Is that correct? And
yep.
You've got bundle A now...
It's now formally released
Just
last month. We had our official launch just in March there. And the first bundle is out, yeah.
And bundle A, that's sort of relatively simple?
So... what we've tried to do, as I said, we've got about 50 actions and they cross a lot of different boundaries. So what we've done is we've tried to make these bundles of 5 or 6 that we're releasing every few months a mix of who needs to be involved. So it might be pharmacists, engineers, clinicians, managers, finance people, etc. Also a mix of the type of process you're doing. So is it an easy win? You know, there are some that are easier and some that are harder. And of course, some that you think are going to be easy but turn out to be harder. We've tried to give a bit of a mix, mainly to try to engender a team. It's all about getting a team together in each hospital. And that's to do with breaking down silos and talking to each other, because that again is one of the key things. We want to get that team together and then try to embed sustainability into every decision we take, whether it's a clinical decision or a managerial decision.
And this bundle A, do you want to quickly talk me through what the high impact parts of bundle A are?
Bundle A, some of our hospitals are well down the route of it anyway, because we've been working on this with the Green Anaesthesia Scotland group for some years. The first one is desflurane use. We've now got rid of that in Scotland. The second one is nitrous oxide manifold decommissioning that we mentioned. We have a couple on the engineering side, so the automation of theatre ventilation, HVAC systems, and theatre anaesthetic gas scavenging systems. We have a specific, what I thought was going to be an easy one, a good example of this, change of intravenous paracetamol perioperatively to oral paracetamol. Something that we'd done in our hospital for the past 12 years or so with no problems, but because it's come about just at a time when Scotland's moving to an online prescribing system, HIPMA, we've got a few hoops to jump through to get that sorted. So that's a good example. And finally, waste segregation, which is a legal requirement anyway in Scotland, as it is in most countries. But to embed that actual segregation at point of use into clinical practice in theatres.
So we've got our bundle that we're going to take forward.
Yep.
How how do you try and institute change?
It's first of all, it's evidence and education. Like most things in our world, evidence and education tell people what the problem is, tell them the reason you want them to change, give them that evidence, because we are all, we're all sensible people. We know that lifelong learning is part of our careers. We recognise that our medical, clinical work changes with new evidence, and we've got to recognise that environment is part of that. And so if there's new evidence comes along suggesting a better way of working, then we should do that.
Now, we all think that change is going to be easy and education will sort everything out. What are the sort of barriers to change that you've found?
Mm-hmm. So clinical autonomy is a barrier to change. We all want to, we expect that what we do is the best we can offer our patients. I often say this, that you know, nobody would choose to give the second best anaesthetic. We think that we're giving the best anaesthetic we possibly can to each patient, and that's, you know, surgical and across medical care. So clinical autonomy, you have to bring people to the table, show them what the evidence is, and ask them to change. And if you're not progressing on that side of a carrot sort of thing, you also then, it's not quite a stick, but you have to ask them to justify their practice. So we often talk about having to address outliers within medical practice, and that's the same. So if somebody wants to continue using a particularly bad drug for environment, that's bad environmentally, you need to ask them to justify that use. You need to ask them to give you the evidence that their practice has significantly better outcomes for their patient or safety implications in order to justify the use of that drug that's particularly bad. Because we've got to get away from the idea that we're only dealing with that patient in front of us. We're dealing with that patient's family, their community, their wider society. So we have to open our minds to that fact and recognise our duties to the wider society.
Yeah, when we think about medical ethics, you know, people talk about our four pillars. Yeah. And you ask people, what are the four pillars? And they say, well, it's autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and the other one.
Yeah.
Because everyone forgets about justice, because you've got a patient in front of you. That's who you can see, and you can't necessarily see the wider impact of things. I'm interested as well, because we talked about people who were outliers there, and you have to bring them in. Is the key not just bringing the outliers in, it's bringing the right other people in as well?
In what way do you mean? The vast majority of your colleagues?
Both the majority of your colleagues, yeah, getting them on side, but also non-anaesthetic colleagues as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're not experts in the field of environmentalism, and certainly we're clinicians. We can learn about it, we can study the subject, and we can ask experts for their assistance. And that's actually what we were talking about in terms of team effort, engineering solutions, innovative solutions with the biotech sector, etc. Industry, we need to talk to industry as well. I had a really interesting conversation just this morning with a laryngoscope manufacturer and provider about the problems that they have in recycling and the standards that they have to reach, even just the obligation they have to provide information leaflets and everything that they send out. So we've got a system that's got some inbuilt waste, some fat that could be pared away if we put our minds to it. But again, yeah, you're right. Experts in different areas of healthcare and out with healthcare do need to be consulted.
I think the industry thing's really interesting as well, because it's a case of, you know, sometimes we think of the tail wagging the dog sort of idea. We've got to reach a balance. Industry need to know what we want.
Yeah. Yeah. I think conversations with industry are very important. it's too easy to blame them. Mm-hmm. But in a way, we've enacted standards that they have to work to. Mm-hmm. But by talking to them about what we see as a problem now, and also beginning to place more emphasis on environmental issues within our procurement processes, mm-hmm. particularly, we can start to influence industry. And I know this is an ongoing thing in many countries already in Europe, some of the Scandinavian countries, mm-hmm. I believe Holland, moving towards a 5% weighting in their procurement process for environmental sustainability. Norway is actually on 30%. Mm-hmm. We have in Scotland a discretionary 5 to 8%, which isn't used very often. But I think that's the key here. Just if you start asking the questions of industry, then they're going to come back with some answers. And they might not be the answers you want initially, but you can start the conversation and then you can work together to see what's a reasonable solution.
And that's probably quite important, because they need to know what we want from them,
yeah.
but we probably need to know the difficulties that they might yeah. have in providing that, yeah. and that's the only way we can actually come to
yeah,
a solution.
We can't, you know, rely on simplistic solutions, what we see as a wasteful linear type system of delivery and use mm-hmm. and throwing away. We need to figure out why it's difficult to reuse that resource, and see if we can influence regulatory authorities, government policy, etc., to see if that can be changed for the better of everyone.
Now, the desflurane thing, that sounds like a bit of a success story there. How do you go about getting that changed at a grassroots level? Because presumably the national change only happened because it happened in individual hospitals.
Yeah, I think it was a grassroots thing. Primarily, we had almost got to zero usage in Scotland before even the government got involved. That's not to downplay their part in it, because mm-hmm. it's actually an important part. The grassroots thing came about purely from a talk by a very nice man called Tom Pierce, an expert in environmental sustainability and anaesthesia from Southampton. And he gave that talk in Scotland in Dunkeld in 2017, and a good number of us colleagues from Green Anaesthesia were at that talk. We started to individually make changes mm-hmm. personally, and then quite often across a department, and found the change was relatively straightforward when you presented the evidence. And then we formed into a grassroots group, as you know, initially a WhatsApp group, you know, I've got a Twitter handle, Green Anaesthesia Scotland. And that actually allowed us to scale up and spread it to many other areas in Scotland that hadn't heard of that particular action. And of course, the grassroots thing took us really quite far in this particular instance, but also identified, when we were talking about other actions, other ideas, that grassroots can be more difficult, and we need more input from hospital managers, directors of finance, these sort of people. Now, we had good, ambitious government targets, and I have to commend the politicians for adopting the targets they have. And we had grassroots activity. Where forming that initial discussion amongst us enthusiasts into a workable document that we could then implement in every theatre, mm-hmm. we had to get formal government and grassroots joining as this thing I call the National Green Theatre Programme, so that the middle bit, the boards of health boards, the directors of finance, the estates people, they could see that this was something that needed to be done and had validity, you know, support from high up, which gave us a little more power to get things done.
And I'm interested, well, and I think it would be good for the audience to hear too. So desflurane in your department was a complex thing that you did to get rid of it?
No, it was really quite simple. Mm-hmm. Obviously, evidence first, a couple of meetings, but then we kind of used nudge.
Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by
just,
that?
Not just food. It's quite simple, really. I mean, we could use educational posters. We could use... I've seen some people putting post-it notes on the desk fluorine vaporizer. I used to go around at the end of each day and take the desfluorine off the vaporizer. This was something, sorry, we had agreed as a department to take the desfluorine off the back bar of the machine and have it still available just in the anaesthetic room in a cupboard. And I used to tour the theatre suite and take off the desfluorine at the end of every day, put it in a cupboard. And it's amazing the power of laziness. if you arrive in theatre with your patient, and there's only sevoflurane and isoflurane there, you know you're going to have to go to the cupboard to get the desfluorine, exchange it, switch it on, wait for it to warm up. They just didn't do it. So in fact, apart from one laggard, everybody adopted it fairly quickly. And I was just going to mention there, you're always going to have some people that hang on to old ways of working. I think the main thing to do is to take the majority with you and leave the laggards. You could spend an awful lot of energy and time trying to bring them with you, but in fact sometimes it's best just to leave them be and they'll come along eventually.
So you'd mentioned 2017 was the sort of breakthrough moment for the Scottish group. So you're not at the start of your sustainability journey. You've done quite a lot of work in Scotland. There's different stages that people are at throughout Europe. What do you wish you'd known in 2017 at the start?
Do you know that I thought about that, and in fact I'm not sure that I can identify something specific that I would have wanted to know back then. I didn't know what I was getting into, that's for sure. I certainly didn't expect to be where I am now in terms of the way my job has changed. But the one thing that I would like to have done was just know earlier. Because I used desfluorine, for instance, for probably 15, 20 years. I used nitrous oxide. I was a reasonably moderately low flow person, but not minimal flow. And I didn't recognize, I was like most people moving towards more environmental practices in my home life, but I didn't recognize that my work life was my major carbon footprint.
So there we go. Probably the best time to start your sustainability journey then
yesterday.
Was yesterday. We've got the Dear Green Place here.
Yeah.
And that's a vision going forward for anaesthesia in Europe and learning from everything that the Scottish group has put forward, and for the Scottish group to learn from all our European neighbours as well. If I could ask you at the end, what do you think somebody listening to their podcasts, they're driving to work or cycling to work or running to work, hopefully, on Tuesday morning, what's the one thing that they should try to start straight away?
Pick an action. Mm-hmm. Pick an action. It doesn't actually matter which one you choose. And I refer you to the National Green Theatre's website, which has a list of actions, but I'm not saying that these are the exclusively right things to do. And although we're pleased and proud of what we've achieved so far, we know that many other countries are well down the environmental pathway already. So you're right that this, the Dear Green Space and at this particular ESAC meeting is very welcome, but the conversations we're having with other people are one of the key things. We're learning as much as anyone else. But I would just pick an action and start it on Tuesday. It's an old mantra from Scottish Patient Safety Programme run by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I think they use Tuesday actually as well, don't they? Start something on Tuesday. Don't wait, just start.
Ken, thank you very much. I think everyone will agree we've learned so much from this podcast. Sustainability is with us. It's what we want to drive away in our profession. And it's going to form, besides patient safety, I think two big pillars of what good anaesthesia is all about. Thank you everyone for listening to this episode. ESAIC releases monthly podcasts on the ESAIC website and various streaming platforms. We hope you will join us for the next one.